Roke Knoll, Tossler said, gazing forward at the far, faint, unmoving wave in the southwest, above the twilight waves. Labannon, standing beside him, said nothing. The cloud cover had dispersed, and the sky arched its pure, uncolored dome over the great circle of the waters. The ship's master joined them. "A fair dawn," he said, whispering in the silence. The east brightened slowly to yellow. Labannon glanced aft. Two of the women were afoot, standing at the rail outside their cabin. Tall women, barefoot, silent, gazing east. The top of the round green hill caught the sunlight first. It was broad daylight when they sailed in between the headlands of Thwill Bay. Everyone aboard was on deck, watching, but still they spoke little and softly. The wind died down within the harbor. It was so still the water reflected the little town that rose above the bay and the walls of the great house that rose above the town. The ship glided on slower, still slower. Labannon glanced at the ship's master and at Onyx. The master nodded. The wizard moved his hands up and outward slowly in a spell and murmured a word. The ship glided on softly, not slowing until she came alongside the longest of the docks. Then the master spoke, and the great sail was furled, while men aboard tossed the lines to men on the dock, shouting, and the silence was broken. There were people on the quay to welcome them, townsfolk gathering, and a group of young men from the school, among them a big, deep-chested, dark-skinned man who held a heavy staff that matched his own height. "Welcome to Roke, King of the Western Lands," he said, coming forward as the gangplank was run out and made fast. "And welcome to all your company." The young men with him, and all the townsfolk, called out hail and greeting to the king, and Labannon answered them merrily as he came down the gangplank. He greeted the master summoner, and they spoke a while. Those watching could see that despite his words of welcome, the master summoner's frowning gaze went to the ship again and again, to the women who stood at the rail, and that his answers did not satisfy the king. When Labannon left him and came back up into the ship, Irian came forward to meet him. "Lord King," she said, "you may tell the masters that I don't want to enter their house this time. I wouldn't enter it if they asked me." Labannon's face was extremely stern. "It is the Master Patterner who asks you to come to him, to the grove," he said. At that, Irian laughed radiant. "I knew he would," he said, "and Tahanu will come with me." "And my mother," Tahanu whispered. He looked at Tanar. He nodded. "So be it," he said. "And the rest of us will be lodged in the great house, unless any of us prefer another place." "By your leave, my lord," Seppel said. "I too will ask the hospitality of the Master Patterner."
"Seppel, that's not necessary," Onyx said harshly. "Come with me to my house."
The Pelnish wizard made a little placating gesture. "No reflection on your friends, my friend," he said. "But I have longed all my life to walk in the eminent grove, and I would be easier there. It may be that the doors of the great house are shut to me as they were before," Alder said, hesitant, and now Onyx's sallow face was red with shame. The princess's veiled head had turned from face to face as she eagerly listened, trying to understand what was said. Now she spoke. "Please, my lord king, I will to be with my friend Tanar, my friend Tehanu, and Irian, and to speak to that Karg." Labannon looked at them all, glanced back to the master summoner standing massively at the foot of the gangplank, and laughed. He spoke from the rail in his clear, affable voice. "My people have been cooped up in ship's cabin, summoner, and it would seem they long for grass underfoot and leaves above their heads. If we all beg the Patterner to take us in, and he agrees, will you forgive our seeming slight to the hospitality of the great house for a time at least?" After a pause, the summoner bowed stiffly. A short, stocky man had come up beside him on the dock and was looking up, smiling at Labannon. He lifted his staff of silver wood.
"Sire," he said,
I took you about the great house once a long time ago and told you lies about everything.
Gamble, said LeBanon.
They met midway on the gangplank and embraced, and talking went down onto the dock. Onyx was the first to follow. He greeted the summoner gravely and with ceremony, then turned to the man called Gamble.
Are you Wind Key now? He demanded.
And when Gamble laughed and said yes, he also embraced him, saying,
A master well made.
Taking Gamble a little aside, he talked with him, eager and frowning. LeBanon looked up to the ship to signal the others to come ashore. And as they came down one by one, he introduced them to the two masters of Roke, Brand the Summoner and Gamble the Wind Key. On most islands of the archipelago, people did not touch palms in greeting, as was the way of inland, but only bowed the head or held both palms open before the heart, as if in offering. When Irian and the summoner met, neither bowed nor made any gesture. They stood stiff with their hands at their sides. The princess made her deep, straight-backed courtesy. Tinar made the conventional gesture, and the summoner returned it. The woman of Gaunt, the daughter of the archmage, Tehanu, LeBanon said. Tehanu dipped her head and made the conventional gesture, but the master summoner stared at her, gasped, and stepped back as if he had been struck.
Mistress Tehanu, said Gamble quickly, coming forward between her and the summoner. We welcome you to Roke, for your father's sake and your mother's and your own. I hope your voyage was a pleasant one.
She looked at him in confusion, and ducked, hiding her face rather than bowed, but she managed to whisper some kind of answer. LeBanon, his face a bronze mask of calm composure, said, Yes, it was a good voyage, Gamble, though the end of it is still in doubt. Shall we walk up through the town now? Tanar? Tehanu? Princess? Or Mirian? He looked at each as he spoke, saying the last name with particular clarity. He set off with Tanar, and the others followed. As Sesarach came down the gangplank, she resolutely swept back the red veils from her face. Gamble walked with Onyx, Alder with Seppel. Tossler stayed with the ship. The last to leave the quay was Brand the Summoner, walking alone and heavily.
Tanar had asked Ged about the grove more than once, liking to hear him describe it. It seems like any grove of trees when you see it first. Not very large. The fields come right up to it on the north and east, and there are hills to the south and usually to the west. It looks like nothing much, but it draws your eye. And sometimes from up on Roke Knoll you can see that it's a forest going on and on. You try to make out where it ends, but you can't. It goes off into the west. And when you walk in it, it seems ordinary again. Though the trees are mostly a kind that grows only there. Tall, with brown trunks. Something like an oak. Something like a chestnut. What are they called? Ged laughed. Arhada, in the old speech. Trees, the trees of the grove, in Hardik. Their leaves don't all turn in autumn, but some at every season, so the foliage is always green, with a gold light in it. Even on a dark day, those trees seem to hold some sunlight. And in the night, it's never quite dark under them. There's a kind of glimmer in the leaves, like moonlight or starlight. Willows grow there, and oak and fir. Other kinds, but as you go deeper in, it's more and more only the trees of the grove. And the roots of those go down deeper than the island. Some are huge trees, some slender, but you don't see many fallen, nor many saplings. They live a long, long time. His voice had grown soft, dreamy. You can walk and walk in their shadow, in their light, and never come to the end of them. But is Roke so large an island? He looked at her peacefully, smiling. The forests here on Gaunt Mountain are that forest, he said. All forests are. And now she saw the grove. Following LeBanon, they had come up through the devious streets of Thwiltown, gathering a flock of townsfolk and children come out to see and greet their king. These cheerful followers dropped away little by little as the travelers left the town on a lane between hedges and farms, which petered out into a footpath past the high, round hill, Roke Knoll. Ged had told her of the knoll, too. There, he said, all magic is strong. There, all things take their true nature. There, he said, our wizardry and the old powers of the earth meet and are one. The wind blew in the high, half-dry grass on the hill. A donkey colt galloped off stiff-legged across a stubble field, flicking and flirting its tail. Cattle walked in slow procession along a fence that crossed a little stream, and there were trees ahead, dark trees, shadowy. They followed Labannon through a stile and over a footbridge to a sunlit meadow at the edge of the wood. A small, decrepit house stood near the stream. Irion broke from their group, ran across the grass to the house, and patted the doorframe as one would pat and greet a beloved horse or dog after long absence. Dear house, she said. And turning to the others, smiling, I lived here, she said, when I was dragonfly. She looked round, searching the eaves of the wood, and then ran forward again. Asver, she called. A man had come out of the shadow of the trees into the sunlight. His hair shone in it like silver gilt. He stood still as Irion ran to him. He lifted his hands to her, and she caught them in hers. I won't burn you. I won't burn you this time, she was saying, laughing and crying, though without tears. I'm keeping my fires out. They drew each other close and stood face to face. And he said to her, Daughter of Kalesan, welcome home. My sister is with me, Asver, she said. He turned his face, a light-skinned, hard, cargish face, Sinar saw, and looked straight at Tehanu. He came to her. He dropped on both his knees before her. Hamagondun, he said, and again, Daughter of Kalesan. Tehanu stood motionless for a moment. Slowly she put out her hand to him, her right hand, the burnt hand, the claw. He took it, bowed his head, and kissed it. My honor is that I was your prophet, woman of Gaunt, he said, with a kind of exulting tenderness. Then rising, he turned at last to Labannon, made his bow, and said, My king, be welcome. It's a joy to me to see you again, Patterner, but I bring a crowd into your solitude. My solitude is crowded already, said the Patterner. A few live souls might keep the balance. His eyes, pale gray-blue-green, glanced round among them. He suddenly smiled, a smile of great warmth, surprising on his hard face. But here are women of my own people, he said in Kargish, and came to Tanar and Seserach, who stood side by side. I am Tanar of Atuan, of Gaunt, he said. With me is the High Princess of the Kargad lands. He made a proper bow. Seserach made her stiff courtesy, but her words poured out, tumultuous, in Kargish. O Lord Priest, I'm glad you're here. If it weren't for my friend Tanar, I would have gone mad, thinking nobody was left in the world that could talk like a human being except the idiot women they sent with me from Awabath. But I am learning to speak as they do, and I am learning courage. Tanar is my friend and teacher, but last night I broke taboo. I broke taboo. O Lord Priest, please tell me what I must do to atone. I walked on the dragon's way. But you were aboard the ship, Princess, said Tanar. I dreamed, Seserach said impatient, and the Lord Patterner is not a priest, but a sorcerer. Princess, said Asver the Patterner, I think we're all walking on the dragon's way, and all taboos may well be shaken or broken, not only in dream. We'll speak of this later under the trees, have no fear, but let me greet my friends, if you will. Seserach nodded regally, and he turned away to greet Alder and Onyx. The princess watched him. He is a warrior, she said to Tanar in Kargish with satisfaction. Not a priest. Priests have no friends. They all moved on slowly and came under the shadow of the trees. Tanar looked up into the arcades and ogives of branches, the layers and galleries of leaves. She saw oaks and a big hemmen tree, but most were the trees of the grove. Their oval leaves moved easily in the air, like the leaves of aspen and poplar. Some had yellowed, and there was a dapple of gold and brown on the ground at their roots. But the foliage in the morning light was the green of summer, full of shadows and deep light. The Patterner led them along a path among the trees. As they went, Tanar thought again about Ged, remembering his voice as he told her about this place. She felt nearer him than she had been since she and Tehanu left him in the dooryard of their house in the early summer, and walked down to Gaunt Port to take the king's ship to Havnor. She knew Ged had lived here with the Patterner of long ago, and had walked here with Asver, She knew the grove was to him the central and sacred place, the heart of peace. She felt that she might look up and see him at the end of one of the long, sun-dappled glades, and that notion eased her heart. For her dream of the night before had troubled her, and when Sesarak burst out with her dream of breaking taboo, Tanar had deeply startled. She too had broken taboo in her dream, transgressed. She had climbed the last three stairs of the empty throne, the forbidden steps. The place of the tombs on Atuan was long ago and far away, and maybe the earthquake had left no throne or steps there at all in the temple where her name had been taken from her. But the old powers of the earth were there, and they were here. They were not changed or moved. They were the earthquake and the earth. Their justice was not man's justice. As she had walked by the round hill, Roke Knoll, she knew she walked where all the powers met. She had defied them long ago, breaking free of the tombs, stealing the treasure, fleeing here to the west. But they were here, under her feet, in the roots of these trees, in the roots of the hill. So here in the center where Earth's powers met, the human powers had also met together, a king, a princess, the masters of wizardry, and the dragons. And a priestess thief turned farm wife, and a village sorcerer with a broken heart. She looked round at Alder. He was walking beside Tehanu. They were talking quietly. Tehanu talked more readily with him than with anyone, even Irion, and looked at ease when she was with him. It cheered Tanar to see them, and she walked on under the great trees, letting her awareness slip into a half-trance of green light and moving leaves. She was sorry when, after only a short way, the patterner halted. She felt she could walk forever in the grove. They gathered in a grassy glade, open to the sky in the center where the branches did not reach to meet. A tributary of the Thwilburn ran across one side of it, willow and alder growing along its course. Not far from the stream was a low, lumpy house built of stone and sod, with a taller lean-to against its wall made of withies and mats of woven reed. "My winter palace? My summer palace," Osver said. Both Onyx and Labanon stared at these small structures in surprise, and Irion said, "I never knew you had a house at all." "I didn't," said the patterner, "but bones get old." With a little fetching and carrying from the ship, the house was soon furnished with bedding for the women and the lean-to for the men. Boys ran back and forth through the eaves of the grove with plentiful provisions from the kitchens of the great house. And late in the afternoon, the masters of Roke came at the invitation of the patterner to meet with the king's party. "Is this where they gather to choose the new archmage?" Tanar asked Onyx, where Ged had told her of that secret glade. Onyx shook his head. "I think not," he said. "The king would know, for he was there when they last met. But maybe only the patterner could tell you. Because things change in this wood, you know. It is not always where it is. Nor are the ways through it ever quite the same, I think. It should be frightening," he said. "But I can't seem to be afraid." Onyx smiled. "So it is here," he said. She watched the masters come into the glade, led by the big bear-like summoner and Gamble, the young weathermaster. Onyx told her who the others were. The changer, the chanter, the herbal, the hand, all gray-haired, the changer frail with age, using his wizard staff as a walking stick. The doorkeeper, smooth-faced and almond-eyed, seemed neither young nor old. The namer, who came last, looked 40 or so. His face was calm and closed. He presented himself to the king, naming himself Coram Carmeric. At that, Irion burst out, indignant. "But you are not!" He looked at her and said evenly, "It is the namer's name." "Then my Coram Carmeric is dead?" He nodded. "Oh," she cried, "that's hard news to bear. He was my friend, when I had few friends here." She turned away and would not look at the namer, angry and tearless in her grief. She had greeted the master herbal with affection and the doorkeeper, but she did not speak to the others. Tanar saw that they watched Irion under their gray brows with uneasy looks. From her they looked at Tehanu and looked away again, and glanced back sidelong, and Tanar began to wonder what they saw when they looked at Tehanu and Irion. For these were men who saw with wizard's eyes. So she bade herself forgive the summoner for his uncouth and unconcealed horror when he first saw Tehanu. Maybe it had not been horror. Maybe it had been awe. When they were all made known to one another and were seated in a circle, with cushions and stump seats for those who needed them, the grass for carpet and sky and leaves for ceiling, the patterner said in his voice that still had some Kargish accent in it.
If it please him, my fellow masters, we will hear the king.
Labanan stood up. As he spoke, Tanar watched him with irrepressible pride. He was so beautiful, so wise in his youth. She did not follow all his words at first, only the sense and passion of them. He told the masters briefly and clearly all the matter that had brought him to Roke, the dragons and the dreams. He ended, "It seemed to us that night by night, all these things draw together, always more certainly to some event, some end. It seemed to us that here, on this ground, with your knowledge and power aiding us, we might foresee and meet that event, not letting it overwhelm our understanding. The wisest of our mages have foretold, a great change is upon us. We must join together to learn what that change is, its causes, its course, and how we may hope to turn it from conflict and ruin to harmony and peace, in whose sign I rule." Brand the summoner stood to answer him. After some stately politeness, with a special welcome to the High Princess, he said, "That the dreams of men, and more than their dreams, forewarn us of dire changes, all the masters and wizards of Roke agree. That there is a disturbance of the deep-set boundaries between death and life. Transgressions of those boundaries and the threat of worse, we confirm. But that these disturbances can be understood or controlled by any but the masters of the art magic, we doubt. And very deeply do we doubt that dragons, whose lives and death are wholly different from that of man, can ever be trusted to submit their wild wrath and jealousy to serve human good."
"Summoner," Labanan said before Irion could speak,
"Orm Embar died for me on Celador. Kalesin bore me to my throne. Here in this circle are three peoples, the Kargish, the Hardik, and the people of the West."
"They were all one people once," said the Namer in his level, toneless voice.
"But they are not now," said the summoner, each word heavy and separate. "Do not misunderstand me, because I speak hard truth, my lord king. I honor the truths you have sworn with the dragons. When the danger we are in is past, Roke will aid Havnor in seeking lasting peace with them. But the dragons have nothing to do with this crisis that is upon us. Nor have the eastern peoples who forswore their immortal souls when they forgot the language of the making."
"Es Ayemra," said a soft, hissing voice. Tehanu, standing.
The summoner stared at her.
"Our language,"
she repeated in Hardik, staring back at him. Irion laughed.
"Es Ayemra," she said.
"You are not immortal," Tanar said to the summoner. She had had no intention of speaking. She did not stand up. The words broke from her like fire from struck rock. "We are. We die to rejoin the undying world. It was you who forswore immortality." Then they were all still. The patterner had made a small movement of his hands, a gentle movement. His face was preoccupied, untroubled, as he studied a design of a few twigs and leaves he had made on the grass where he sat, just in front of his crossed legs. He looked up, looked round at them all. "I think we will have to go there soon," he said. After another silence, Labanan asked,
"Go where, my lord?"
"Into the dark," said the patterner.
As Alder sat listening to them speak, slowly the voices grew faint, fading, and the warm late sunlight of late summer dimmed into darkness. Nothing was left but the trees, tall, blind presences between the blind earth and the sky, the oldest living children of the earth. "Oh, Segoy," he said in his heart, "maid and maker, let me come to you." The darkness went on and on, past the trees, past everything. Against that emptiness he saw the hill, the high hill that had been on their right as they walked up out of the town. He saw the dust of the road, the stones of the path that led past that hill. He turned now aside from the path, leaving the others, and walked up the slope. The grasses were tall. The spent flower cases of sparkweed nodded among them. He came on a narrow path and followed it up the steep hillside. Now, I am myself, he said in his heart. Segoy, the world is beautiful. Let me come through it to you. I can do again what I was meant to do, he thought as he walked. I can mend what was broken. I can rejoin. He reached the top of the hill. Standing there in the sun and wind, among the nodding grasses, he saw on his right the fields, the roofs of the little town and the big house, the bright bay and the sea beyond it. If he turned, he would see behind him in the west the trees of the endless forest, fading on and on into blue distances. Before him, the hill slope was dim and gray, going down to the wall of stones and the darkness beyond the wall, and the crowding, calling shadows at the wall. I will come, he said to them. I will come. Warmth fell across his shoulders and his hands. Wind stirred in the leaves above his head. Voices spoke, speaking, not calling, not crying out his name. The patterner's eyes were watching him across the circle of grass. The summoner, too, was watching him. He looked down, bewildered. He tried to listen. He gathered his mind and listened. The king was speaking, using all his skill and strength to hold these fierce, willful men and women to one purpose. Let me try to tell you, masters of Roke, what I learned from the High Princess as we sailed here. Princess, may I speak for you? Unveiled, she gazed across the circle at him and bowed grave permission. This is her tale, then. Long ago, the human and the dragon peoples were one kind, speaking one language. But they sought different things, and so they agreed to part, to go different ways. That agreement was called the Vedernan. Onyx's head went up, and Sepple's bright, dark eyes widened. Verwa Nadan, he whispered. The human beings went east, the dragons west. The humans gave up their knowledge of the language of the making, and in exchange received all skill and craft of hand, and ownership of all that hands can make. The dragons let go all such things, but they kept the old speech. And their wings, said Irian. And their wings, Labanan said. He had caught Asver's eye. Patterner, perhaps you can continue the story better than I. The villagers of Gaunt and Hur at Hur remember what the wise men of Roke and the priests of Corrego forget, Asver said. Yes, as a child I was told this tale, I think, or something like it. But the dragons had been forgotten in it. It told how the dark folk of the archipelago broke their oath. We had all promised to forego sorcery and the language of sorcery, speaking only our common tongue. We would name no names and make no spells. We would trust to Segoy, to the powers of the earth, our mother, mother of the warrior gods. But the dark folk broke the covenant. They caught the language of the making in their craft, writing it in runes. They kept it, taught it, used it. They made spells with it, with the skill of their hands, with false tongues speaking the true words. So the Kargish people can never trust them. So says the tale. Irian spoke. Men fear death as dragons do not. Men want to own life, possess it as if it were a jewel in a box. Those ancient mages craved everlasting life. They learned to use true names to keep men from dying, but those who cannot die can never be reborn. The name and the dragon are one, said Kurum Karmeric the Namer. We men lost our names at the Verwa Nadan, but we learned how to regain them. Name is self. Why should death change that? He looked at the summoner, but Brand sat heavy and grim, listening, not speaking. "Say more of this, Namer, if you will," the king said. "I say what I have half learned, half guessed, not from village tales, but from the most ancient records in the Isolate Tower. 1,000 years before the first kings of Enlad, there were men in Ea and Solea, the first and greatest of the mages, the rune-makers. It was they who learned to write the language of the making. They made the runes, which the dragons never learned. They taught us to give each soul its true name, which is its truth, its self. And with their power they granted to those who bear their true name life beyond the body's death. Life immortal," Sepple's soft voice took the word. He spoke, smiling a little. "In a great land of rivers and mountains and beautiful cities, where there is no suffering or pain, and where the self endures unchanged, unchanging forever, that is the dream of the ancient lore of Palm. Where," the summoner said, "where is that land?" "On the other wind," said Irion. "The west beyond the west." She looked round at them all, scornful, irate. "Do you think we dragons fly only on the winds of this world? Do you think our freedom, for which we gave up all possessions, is no greater than that of the mindless seagulls? That our realm is a few rocks at the edge of your rich islands? You own the earth, you own the sea, but we are the fire of sunlight, we fly the wind. You wanted land to own, you wanted things to make and keep, and you have that. That was the division, the Verwe Nadan. But you were not content with your share. You wanted not only your cares, but our freedom. You wanted the wind. And by the spells and wizardries of those oath-breakers, you stole half our realm from us, walled it away from life and light, so that you could live there forever. Thieves! Traitors!" "Sister," Tehanu said, "these are not the men who stole from us. They are those who pay the price." A silence followed her harsh, whispering voice. "What was the price?" said the Namer. Tehanu looked at Irion. Irion hesitated and then said in a much subdued voice, "Greed puts out the sun." These are Kalesin's words. Asver, the patterner, spoke. As he spoke, he looked into the aisles of the trees across the clearing, as if following the slight movements of the leaves. The ancients saw that the dragon's realm was not of the body only, that they could fly outside of time, it may be, and envying that freedom, they followed the dragon's way into the west beyond the west. There they claimed part of that realm as their own, a timeless realm where the self might be forever, but not in the body, as the dragons were. Only in spirit could men be there. So they made a wall which no living body could cross, neither man nor dragon, for they feared the anger of the dragons. And their arts of naming laid a great net of spells upon all the western lands, so that when the people of the islands die, they would come to the west beyond the west and live there in the spirit forever. But as the wall was built and the spell laid, the wind ceased to blow within the wall, the sea withdrew, the springs ceased to run, the mountains of sunrise became the mountains of the night. Those that died came to a dark land, a dry land. I have walked in that land, Labanan said, low and unwillingly. I do not fear death, but I fear it. There was a silence among them. Cobb And Thorion, the summoner, said in his rough, reluctant voice, they tried to break down that wall, to bring the dead back into life. Not into life, master, Seppel said. Still, like the rune-makers, they sought the bodiless, immortal self. Yet their spells disturbed that place, the summoner said, brooding. So the dragons began to remember the ancient wrong, and so the souls of the dead come reaching now across the wall, yearning back to life. Alder stood up. He said, it is not life they yearn for. It is death, to be one with the earth again, to rejoin it. They all looked at him, but he hardly knew it. His awareness was half with them, half in the dry land. The grass beneath his feet was green and sunlit, was dead and dim. The leaves of the trees trembled above him, and the low stone wall lay only a little distance from him, down the dark hill. Of them all, he saw only Tehanu. He could not see her clearly, but he knew her, standing between him and the wall. He spoke to her. They built it, but they cannot unbuild it, he said. Will you help me, Tehanu? I will, Hara, she said. A shadow rushed between them, a great, dark, bulky strength, hiding her, seizing him, holding him. He struggled, gasped for breath, could not draw breath, saw red fire in the darkness, and saw nothing more.